The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and LitHub Radio.
No matter what you're looking for in a non-alcoholic beer, there's only one name that has it all. Athletic Brewing Co. Full flavor? It's athletic. Huge variety? It's athletic. Award-winning styles you can get online, at the bar, or the grocery store? It's athletic. In fact, when it comes to amazing non-alcoholic beer, there's no question. It's athletic. Ask for it and find out. Go to askforathletic.com to find your closest retailer today. Near beer.
As a plant-based cheese company, Daiya has never talked about beef in an ad before, because someone somewhere once had a beef with saying beef and plant-based together. So putting a slice of Daiya cheese on a beef burger, not okay. Well, our delicious melty cheese has a beef with your beef about beef, because any step towards plant-forward eating is a step in the right direction. Daiya, 100% plant-based, even if you're not. Now made with Daiya Oat Cream Blend.
Hi, I'm your inner dream monologue, and you're fast asleep, so I'll be quick. Great job using the Colgate Optic White Overnight Teeth Whitening Pen before bed. When used as directed, it gives you a visibly whiter smile in just 7 days. So while I fly and talk to animals, you're removing teeth stains with ease. Sweet dreams. And when you wake up, keep on living life to the brightest. Colgate Optic White. Find it at all major retailers.
Today's episode of the History of Literature podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/HOL. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. That's www.audibletrial.com/HOL. Welcome to the History of Literature podcast. I'm Jack Wilson. We have a great show today. We're going to be talking about Virginia Woolf, the great novelist, the genius novelist, one of the true luminaries of modernism. We'll have a special guest too, more on that in a moment. But first, let me thank you all for visiting us and for sending us your emails and leaving comments. We're happy to have you on board. Please do subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. It really helps us out. 'Tis the season, people. The season for helping out your favorite literary podcast. Actually, I don't know if we were ever quite your favorite. I think we peaked at number 4 behind 3 podcasts dedicated to Harry Potter news. So, 'tis the season for helping out your 4th favorite literary podcast. And J.K. Rowling is on her own. How will she ever manage? So, Virginia Woolf was born in 1882 and died in 1941. Her accomplishments are almost without parallel. Her novels, Mrs. Dalloway, To the Lighthouse, Orlando. Well, let's go through the years, the chronology, because I think this is important. We're going to be looking at a key essay of hers today called Modern Fiction. So let's recap where she was when she wrote that essay. So her first two novels, The Voyage Out, came out in 1915, and Night and Day came out in 1919. Those were her first two novels, and then she wrote this essay called Modern Fiction in 1919. This essay is very influential. It's kind of a manifesto where she sets forth what modern fiction does and can do and should do. She cites the Russians, Chekhov, for example, and James Joyce, who was, Dubliners came out in 1914, and Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man came out in 1916. Okay, so things were starting to change. And then Ulysses. Excerpts of Ulysses started coming out. We see the what's often called the stream of consciousness style coming out. It was serialized in the Little Review. Came out, began in March 1918. Came out in serialized form. And that was really a shock to the system, to the literary system. Virginia Woolf was writing this essay in that context. And she was trying to set forth, well, maybe I should say, she wasn't just trying to set forth. She was setting forth what modern fiction, quote unquote, really is. She contrasts modern fiction with some bestsellers of the day, H.G. Wells, John Galsworthy, and Arnold Bennett. Those three were more throwbacks to the 19th century, to the days of Trollope and Thackeray. And Wolfe praises the earlier giants like Henry Fielding and Jane Austen in this essay. But really, she's at her best. She's beautiful in describing what she wants modern fiction to do. Here's a quote. She says, quote, "Let us record the atoms as they fall upon the mind in the order in which they fall. Let us trace the pattern, however disconnected and incoherent in appearance, which each sight or incident scores upon the consciousness. Let us not take it for granted that life exists more fully in what is commonly thought big than in what is commonly thought small." End quote. It just doesn't get better than that. And then she herself went on to write novels in that style that tried to record the atoms as they fell upon the mind in the order in which they fell. Or maybe I should say, instead of writing novels in that style, maybe I should say that she wrote with that goal in mind, keeping that goal in mind, and in doing so, she discovered and developed a style that would suit her artistic purposes. In 1922, she published Jacob's Room, and then the great novels of Virginia Woolf, Mrs. Dalloway in 1925, To the Lighthouse in 1927, Orlando in 1928, and The Waves in 1931. She went on to write two more. What's so curious, at least to me, about the essay Modern Fiction is that she seems to be of two minds. It's almost like she's two different critics. On the one hand, she's supremely confident, and yet there are places in the essay where she's strangely hesitant. Why? Why would a genius have a hard time saying what she means? Was she trying not to offend? Or was there something else here? Was she hedging her bets? Was she worried that a departure from the conventional might be viewed the wrong way? Or that she might be getting it wrong? But why would a genius like Virginia Woolf worry about that? Her descriptions of what is important and essential about fiction are so clear and so beautiful, and she was right, at least if we think of Joyce and Chekhov and Tolstoy and Austen and Fielding, and if we think of those as the authors worth reading, and we think of H.G. Wells and Arnold Bennett and John Galsworthy as being authors who may have been popular in their day, but are inessential. If that's how we view the literature, the literary pantheon, then Virginia Woolf was getting it all right. Here's another possibility. Maybe I just don't understand the essay. I've thought about that. Maybe there's a kind of shorthand here, an assumed knowledge that I just can't participate in. Maybe I would understand better if I were a contemporary reader of Ms. Woolf's. Immersed in Bennett and Galsworthy and H.G. Wells and all the conventions of the day, all the successes, all the bestsellers, I've barely read any of those books. Probably read four or five by H.G. Wells, but I'm not sure I fully understand what she's working against in this essay, because I'm not that familiar with any of the people that she's talking about. I haven't read Bennett and Galsworthy at all. So that's the preface to today's discussion, A Genius in Mid-Career, an essay that's like a manifesto for herself and her entire era, and me, puzzled by it all, admiring the strengths and puzzled by the gaps. And then I heard about a course being taught at the University of Michigan, a graduate seminar in Virginia Woolf, where the goal was to better understand Woolf in general and this essay in particular. And the students were going to read these three authors, the enemies of Virginia Woolf, using enemies in an artistic sense, her opponents, certainly, her foils, the ceiling of conventionality that she was trying to push through. And the seminar was going to see how reading these three authors helped them, the students, understand Virginia Woolf. This was the answer. The key to unlock Woolf and modernism, maybe. So the leader of the seminar, Professor Andrea Zemgulis, was kind enough to join me for a conversation. We'll pick that up mid-discussion, the point where she and I started to really dig into the essay, Modern Fiction. After that, we'll have some guests on the show. Jack Wilson Jr. and Jack Wilson Jr. Jr. are going to join us to give us some thoughts on children's books. Some of you might have kids in your life, and some of you might be buying those kids books for the holidays. You think you know what they want? We'll ask a couple of actual kids to tell us the truth. All that and more today on the History of Literature podcast. So let's talk about the essay.
All right.
This is why I'm so interested in your current project, the seminar that you're teaching now.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I read this essay, I kind of feel like I can tell that I'm seeing what Virginia Woolf is, what she's saying. And mm-hmm. I can tell that it's a real takedown, you know, a real critical mm-hmm. takedown mm-hmm. of these mm-hmm. authors. And I can tell that she's setting forth her own kind of artistic, almost a manifesto, I guess. But mm-hmm. it's also really difficult to understand because the authors that she's describing, it seems like all the ones that she's praising, I was familiar with, like Joyce and Chekhov and mm-hmm. some of the others. But all of the ones that she's really criticizing and kind of setting herself against are, I mean, I had heard of H.G. Wells, but I had not read much more than the science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And she mentions a few others whom I had not read, and I think most people today don't read. So tell us about the graduate seminar, and then we'll talk about kind of what you've been getting out of it.
Right. Well, part of it is just taking up that situation that we're all in, which is the battle she's fighting are against people we don't read anymore. So how can we understand her?
Right.
Without kind of understanding the opponents. And so at the most basic level, we're just reading a kind of selection of the fiction by these writers. You know, to some extent, we think, oh, yeah, she's right in some ways and kind of inaccurate in others. Although when we read this essay, we feel like she's having trouble putting her finger on exactly what bothers her
right.
about them.
Right. She kind of circles around it a couple
yeah.
of times.
Yeah.
Let me read a quote here so we can kind of set this on set the table a little bit. So she's talking about H.G. Wells, Arnold Bennett, and John Galsworthy. And she says, Mr. Wells, Mr. Bennett, and Mr. Galsworthy have excited so many hopes and disappointed them so persistently that our gratitude largely takes the form of thanking them for having shown us what they might have done but have not done, what we certainly could not do, but as certainly, perhaps, do not wish to do.
Mm-hmm.
So she really is kind of, it's sort of this faint praise mm-hmm. of, you know, they have all of this talent in a way, mm-hmm. and they're somebody mm-hmm. worth taking seriously, but at the same time, they seem to be completely missing the boat on what fiction is and should try to do. Is that kind
mm-hmm.
of a fair
yeah.
reading?
Yeah, that's fair. And to some extent, I think she's being polite. And to some extent, I think she's can't put her finger on exactly what's
right.
wrong with them. To some extent, grouping them together doesn't entirely make sense, other than that they are the most famous writers of the day.
Right.
They are the most successful, but they're very different. So the part of her struggle is saying, well, you know, how are they all getting it wrong? Which is, you know, a hard thing to do. What I picked up on when you're reading that is kind of the kind of syntactical hesitation
yeah,
that's going
right,
on. And
right. yeah, her next sentence is no single phrase will sum up the charge or grievance. And then the next sentence starts, if we tried to formulate our meaning in one word, we should.
Mm-hmm.
It almost seems like she's kind of groping her way forward.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's because she was just, this was all so new that it was mm-hmm. hard to. It's easier to see in retrospect the difference between mm-hmm. someone like James Joyce and the kind of novels. But maybe it was just hard to see as it was unfolding in real time.
Yeah, I imagine it was. And
yeah.
and I don't think she knew that, as you called this a manifesto, I think she was just being a critic, had an assignment, and was just trying to sort out what she saw was going on in contemporary literature. I don't think she had any idea it would become this lens through which we read both her work and the period.
Right.
But it has become that.
And it's interesting because I don't think I gave the year of this, but it was written in 1919 and published in 1921. So she had published a couple of her early books, but she had not, you know, she it was still ahead of her to write Mrs. Dalloway and To the Lighthouse. Right, right. And so it almost seems like she's trying to figure out, how do I want to write? What makes sense to me? And why do these books leave me? Why do they fall flat for me? Or why do they feel me? Why do they seem like they're wanting something to me? Mm-hmm. And when I read The Russians or Joyce, I feel something different, and I want to do that.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
So she describes the difference. At one point, she says, if we had to pick one word, we would say they are materialists. Mm-hmm. And they're concerned not with the spirit, but with the body. Mm-hmm. Well, how do you make sense of that distinction? And are you seeing that as you're reading these works of these individuals?
So when I've come across the word materialist, like in a, we read, I mean, it can have many meanings, but we read The Island of Dr. Moreau by Wells, and there comes up with this accusation of a materialism. And it just means that radically non-idealist, right? There only is the material world. There is no spiritual world. Mm. And I don't think she means that, although she does use the language of the soul and the spirit. When she uses soul and spirit, she's still talking about human life in a non kind of theistic or spiritual kind of, what's the word? Not in a religious way, I'll just say that.
Right.
And so when she uses materialists against these people, it's to say that they only think of life as the needs of the body, money, houses, and a kind of conventional morality, and that kind of the kind of truth and happiness and beauty that she sees in life and through her literature is just not at all interesting to these writers.
Right, right. She has this great line about H.G. Wells where she says, out of the goodness of his heart, and then she says, he takes upon his shoulders work that ought to have been done by government officials.
Yeah, totally.
So, like, I think that's kind of what you're saying, right? Like, he's sort of talking about, well, how do we get the greatest happiness for the greatest number? Or how do we solve the problem of you know, the housing crisis or whatever the social issue of the day is? He's putting that into his fiction.
Yeah. And he's very optimistic. That, you know, if we're all industrious and if society is organized better, and she criticizes it for that, that we'll get somewhere, you know, we will achieve that goal.
Right. And then this was kind of an interesting phrase. She says he forgets in the plethora of ideas and facts, he forgets the crudity and coarseness of his human beings, which is kind of the opposite of what I would have thought, that, you know, sort of the first idea that one might have is that Virginia Woolf is writing about kind of a higher plane of society, or
totally,
you know, and the idea that she's accusing one of these others of forgetting the crudity and coarseness is kind of an interesting accusation for her to make.
There's plenty of crude and coarse characters in this novel, so I kind of don't understand it.
Right.
I mean, in this same essay, she, you know, kind of talks about, you know, life is big, not small. It's the conception that matters. And so it doesn't even sit well with that, like, that she's chiding them for failing there, for kind of presenting two idealistic characters.
Yeah. I wonder if she means, like, that he doesn't have enough complexity of the character, that they're not deep enough. Maybe that's what she means by coarseness, that they're more types to be pushed around by the author to kind of make a larger point.
Yeah, I think that would make sense, but I also think we don't have to read her essays as, you know, exemplary,
right.
linear progressions. Like, they're not, they are, you know, they are very smart, a lot, you know, and a lot of them are structured perfectly, but, you know, sometimes she's a little off the mark or undercuts her point, and that's okay. We could probably figure something out, but I don't think we always have to.
Right. And she wasn't sort of under oath, and she probably wasn't thinking that, you know, 100 years later, people would be trying to parse through individual phrases.
Right.
So I'm interested in the other two as well. And also she mentions Arnold, I guess that's Bennett, that it's well-crafted but no life. And she asks the question, how do the characters live and what do they live for?
Yeah.
Is that been your experience when you've been reading Arnold Bennett?
No, I mean, because my experience of reading, so we for this class, for example, I mean, I've read other Arnold Bennett, and he does have a huge range of styles. So, but we decided to focus on his Hilda Lessways, which he takes on in this essay. We also watched a movie that he wrote the screenplay for.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Oh yeah, he was very successful writer. So what happened in class is we bemoaned a lot of the craftsmanship. We didn't understand. I mean, it was a plot that had structure and there were relationships at that level. It all worked, but there were so many annoying refound features of his style.
Oh,
that
right.
I mean, I found a selection for you.
Okay.
If you want to. So, and you go, he writes better than I could. So I do want to say that, even though I'm going to say, you know, that we did not find him the great craftsman that she celebrates him as. And I should say that's just, I think, just a nod to, I mean, it is a kind of a double-edged sword. Like, to say he's a craftsman is a bit of an insult.
Right, when as opposed to an artist.
Yeah, or someone with conception, right? Because his essay, his review of Jacob's Room complains about, you know, writers these days are too clever, right? Cleverness takes down. And so she's taking down
the workmanlike, practical.
So here's a scene between a mother and a daughter, Hilda and her mother. After they have a fight, the paragraph reads, "They kissed. Such a candid peacemaking had never occurred between them before. Mrs. Lessways, as simple in forgiveness as in wrath, did not disguise her pleasure in the remarkable fact that it was Hilda who had made the overture. Hilda thought, 'How strange I am. What is coming over me?' She glanced at the range, in which was a pale gleam of red, and that gleam, in the heavy twilight, seemed to her to be inexpressibly, enchantingly mournful. And she herself was mournful about the future, very mournful. She saw no hope. Yet her sadness was beautiful to her, and she was proud." There's a lot of writing like that, and I felt it was something like over narration or over direction, where she feels this way, but a twinge that way.
Yep.
And it's, you know, I mean, it's easy to read, but it verges on like just too much explanation.
Yeah. It's pretty clunky.
Pretty clunky. Yeah. And a lot of it reads that way.
Right.
You know, so not horrible. And I'd say I'm sure it would be better than anything I wrote.
Yeah. But you could see where Virginia Woolf would be saying, you know, she was seeing other people. Certainly Joyce was much more mature than that in terms of style. And you could see where she would be admiring someone like that.
Yeah.
And then it's interesting that this kind of circles back to what we were talking about earlier, where you were saying that when you finished some of her books and you weren't sure exactly what they were about, she really talks about that with Chekhov in particular. And that seems to be kind of the opposite of what she's describing of that passage you just read of Bennett.
Yeah.
Where she basically says, let's see if I can pull it here. She says, "In every great Russian writer, we seem to discern the features of a saint. If sympathy for the sufferings of others, love towards them, endeavor to reach some goal worthy of the most exacting demands of the spirit, constitute saintliness. It is the saint in them which confounds us with a feeling of our own irreligious triviality and turns so many of our famous novels to tinsel and trickery. The conclusions, and this is the best part, the conclusions of the Russian mind thus comprehensive and compassionate, are inevitably, perhaps, of the utmost sadness. More accurately, indeed, we might speak of the inconclusiveness of the Russian mind. It is the sense that there is no answer, that if honestly examined, life presents question after question, which must be left to sound on and on after the story is over, in hopeless interrogation that fills us with a deep, and finally, it may be, with a resentful despair. That's you. That's you as an undergrad reading her.
That's many. Yeah, and many current undergrads too. Yeah, sure.
But she just loves the Russians. She loves the soul and the heart. And it also interested me that she gave a lot of credit to the people who had come before her, you know, the Henry Fielding and Jane Austen. And she really seemed to just be dissatisfied with a very particular style of writing that was probably, you know, best-selling taking up a lot of the literary scene. Although, you know, it's hard not to say, maybe that's one of the other reasons why this essay is so famous, is because it looks like she looks like a prophet, you know? Singles out for praise is somebody that we read today, and everybody she criticizes is somebody who fell by the wayside.
Right. And I think in our class at least, certainly the students think it's a bit unfair to Galsworthy. Like, we should still be reading Galsworthy.
Oh. So why? Yeah. What do they like about Galsworthy?
It's just a serious, well-written novel. It is actually does have good style. It has interesting ideas. And it does seem to be this kind of culmination of, you know, the 19th century novel that nobody ever gets to because it's published in the 20th century.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there's interesting modernist things in it, like a kind of emptiness that structures and drives the plot. Like, there's an empty house and an empty character where she has no details filled in. So it does interesting things, but she is much more polite to Galsworthy than she is to the other two.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think
she lumps him in with them.
Yeah.
She says, you know, we speak of quarreling with Mr. Wells, Mr. Bennett, and Mr. Galsworthy. And then she has, you know, a page on Bennett, a page on Wells, you know, a paragraph that's the length of a page on each of them. And then for Galsworthy, the only thing I could find that she said was, nor, profoundly though we respect the integrity and humanity of Mr. Galsworthy, shall we find what we seek in his pages.
These other authors,
she's got such good lines, and she really is very penetrating criticism. And with him, she just kind of, she seems to be saying, like, well, he's not in the category. Yeah. He's not Chekhov.
He's not Chekhov, right? and I think because he is working in the tradition, there's plenty of examples. Like, we didn't need Galsworthy to happen, right? We didn't need to go there. We're at this point, we're done with that way of representing the world.
Right. So let me tell you I did read an essay by, I guess he's a critic. I'm not familiar with him, but his name is Simon Heffer, and he was writing in the Telegraph. And he wrote this essay about Virginia Woolf and her descriptions of these authors. And he basically made the point that he said, you know, when I read this when I was younger, I accepted this dichotomy, but then something in me told me that I should go read the authors and see what I thought. And then he had a completely different view. And he said, I found that these three were much more valuable than I had assumed before. And that maybe Woolf and her crowd were snobbish, and they were overly focused on a kind of aestheticism and a rarefied artistic sensibility. And that the other three were doing more, I guess, proletarian work or describing life as it really was.
Did he say that about Galsworthy? That doesn't really make sense, but
Is
it really just Bennett and Wells?
I would have to go back and look at the at the essay to see.
Because he's very artsy and aesthetic.
Oh, right. Okay.
So, I mean, I think I, there's other people who've written similar essays who say Virginia Woolf was wrong and she's done this crime, right? But as we already talked about, she didn't know her essay would be read for 100 years.
Right.
And I wouldn't disagree at the point that there's value to these people that she's setting aside, but the kind of urgency and the battle she feels, I mean, she uses that word, a battle. We've reached the stage of battle. Like this is a high stakes thing. The oppression she feels as a young writer with a literary establishment heavily weighted behind these people, that she was the underdog and now she isn't. Now she's, a genius writer.
Right.
But at the time she was the underdog and I was really moved by, she does a good job making her argument, but I was much more moved by an essay by George Orwell, who similarly takes down I think he also takes down Shaw. He takes down Shaw, Wells, Galsworthy, and Bennett. It's an essay that he read on the Indian service on the radio and he says, these people had such an insular mindset. This is little England that got us into the war and we have to be part of Europe. We have to be part of the world. And, writers who wrote that way and think this way, we have to stop reading them.
Right.
And I think, it works with Woolf in the sense that, I don't think she was invoking that context, but we can read her in that context of battling these people who represent a mentality that rules and was rewarded and led to the First World War, and so that it was a really urgent message to send.
Right.
That nowadays you can just just think of her as the winner, the victor, and
right. But it's interesting.
But I enjoy reading, right.
I was just going to say that that's so fascinating because it does seem like when you read the Bennett, it seems like somebody who is convinced that he knows exactly how the world works what you can say with truth and how readers will respond and here we're going to do this and we're going to do that. And then when you think about what Virginia Woolf was crying out for, to have the uncertainty and the plunges into darkness and to not just assume that the readers and society would all respond uniformly. And it sounds like Orwell had his finger on the same thing and was looking at how it can lead a society into a kind of complacency or a kind of insularity, like you said.
Very, very perceptive of you to hear that just out of a reading. And my students and I were bothered both in Wells and in Bennett by a kind of condescension toward characters.
Right.
That exactly the way you're speaking, where knowing a human and knowing kind of just being very cocksure about just how they feel precisely and how much you need to know.
Right.
Exactly what you said.
I've kind of heard people say that E.M. Forster, who I know is another someone else that you write, is kind of like maybe the last genuine omniscient voice, that he was still he was maybe one of the latest ones who was still using that assumed omniscience for the narrator.
And that
it just, people recognized there was too much uncertainty and that you could never really speak for people the way that the 19th century authors assumed that you could.
Yeah.
Last question. If you could summarize what you think you gained in your knowledge of Woolf from reading these works that she was pushing against, what would you say that you learned?
I'd say that, the struggle she had to define exactly what were the crimes these writers were committing. I think I agree with her. Like, she's doing them justice in a way. Like, I don't think she's getting them wrong in some ways, but in terms of their style, I don't think she had quite herself figured out what exactly they were doing wrong. And so, as you were saying earlier, there is this struggle. She doesn't struggle as much, I think, when she starts getting to the writers we read now and kind of coming up with those formulations, like let us record the atoms as they fall upon the mind and the order in which they fall, right? Suddenly her language just becomes beautiful and lyric as she's setting out this plan for her own writing. And so I think I hadn't quite appreciated how as you're saying earlier, she was on the verge of a major transformation in style, that even describing it was easier, even though I think it was a huge, you know, this revolutionary accomplishment, even describing it was easier for her than it was to describe what other people were doing wrong.
Right.
That she is kind of Mrs. Marx and is catty and clever and with those parts. And that was actually a struggle for her, I think, to figure out what these writers were doing wrong. But,
you know, it just occurred to me that in some ways, everybody who came after, like you and me and everybody else who was reading this essay, we have this huge advantage over her, which is, you know, we assume that she knows exactly what she means, but we have the advantage of having read the works that she went on to write.
Yeah, right.
And she hadn't read those yet. She hadn't written them yet. So she, you know, so she...
Right.
It's like she's building this bridge, and we see where the bridge is going to end and where, you know, the cliff on the other side. Yeah. And she's just building a bridge into thin air. And it's not the same, you know, not really knowing exactly what's going to be on that other side when she finishes her bridge.
Right, exactly. Well put.
Okay. Well, put. Professors.
Can I just say one? Oh, wait, sure. I want to say one more thing. I didn't learn this through the class, but it kind of just keeps bringing it back to me, is that in her private writing, and even in something like A Room of One's Own, she is incredibly anxious as to whether she will be a first-rate, second-rate writer.
Yeah.
And so I think she can take down these writers because she's confident they are second-rate. She's absolutely confident.
Yep.
She gets more nervous about, you know, someone like Joyce, where she didn't enjoy it like she knew she was supposed to, but she also knew... he might be first rate and she might not be first rate, and she really wanted to be. So that I sense that tension in this essay, or that anxiety.
Right. And it's almost like she's looking at it, and it's that line again where she says they're doing something that we cannot, but then again, it might be something that we do not wish to do. Like she's going to perfect her craft, but she wants to make sure that she's perfecting the right kind of craft.
Yeah. Because I know how anxious she was about her own rank. How would she rate at the end of her career? So sometimes she's much more reticent in teaching and talking about writers than she is in this essay. And so it definitely was really bold, really bold essay. And now it's just read as snobbish and, you know, queenly, right? But actually, it was really gutsy and would have made her anxious.
I read it and feel like she's challenging herself, that she's she's setting the mark out, and she's saying, this is what I need to live up to, or I won't consider myself a success. And she sets it out there very high. And then I think she made it, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. Yes. Good for her.
Okay, Professor Zemgulis, thank you for joining us today on the History of Literature podcast.
You're welcome.
Wasn't that great? Oh, man. There is so much to learn. You can hear me in that interview, learning in real time. My thanks to Professor Andrea Zemgulis for the excellent conversation. We had to leave a lot of it on the cutting room floor, too. And I think we're going to invite her back for some good E.M. Forster discussions. So much to look forward to in the new year. But first, we have the holidays to get through. Hey, we all know it's true. People don't read much anymore. They're too busy on their phone. And they snatch their news from the internet. But the exception is kids. Kids are still reading. People still buy books for kids. Everyone agrees that a child reading a book is a good thing. And frankly, we all want to buy good books for kids. So let's talk to a couple of kids to see what they want. What they really want. Okay, I'm joined now by Jack Wilson Jr. Jack Wilson Jr., how are you today?
I'm good.
Okay, so we're going to be talking about Christmas books for kids, and let's get let's talk about you first. So how old are you?
I'm 12.
Okay, and you're a 12-year-old male, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so you're going to be speaking on behalf of 12-year-old boys this year. And the first thing I wanted to ask you is whether you and most of your friends get books for Christmas.
Well, yeah.
And you consider that to be a good gift?
Yeah.
Okay, because you like to read?
Yeah.
Okay, so why do adults give kids books?
They give kids books because they want them to learn and be educated and not just play video games all the time.
Okay, are those good goals in your view?
I think.
Okay. So what type of books do you think parents or teachers think that a 12-year-old would like?
Well, since they like to educate, like educational books, they probably would want to give them books about historical fiction or realistic fiction.
Okay. And does that match up with what kids actually want to get?
Well, not really, because usually kids want to get books that are more interesting. Like, they have a good setting, like Rick Riordan has good books for setting, or comics, because some comics are good, like Calvin and Hobbes or Peanuts.
Okay. So would a Rick Riordan book be educational in your view?
It sort of, because it teaches you about myths.
Okay. So a parent might feel good about getting a Rick Riordan book, even if it's maybe not their first choice.
Yeah.
Okay. And how about Calvin and Hobbes? Do you learn from Calvin and Hobbes?
Yeah. You learn about philosophy.
Oh, okay. Do you remember any philosophy that you learned from Calvin and Hobbes?
No.
I think, how long have you been reading Calvin and Hobbes?
I don't know.
Maybe since about first grade?
Maybe.
Yeah. Okay.
Know.
You're in seventh grade now?
Yeah.
And you haven't learned a single thing?
Yeah.
You're not really making the case here. I think there's probably more that you've absorbed that maybe you're just not remembering right now.
Yeah.
And vocabulary, you can learn that from Calvin and Hobbes?
Yeah.
Okay. Any other examples of things? I think you said Peanuts. So comic books. How about graphic novels?
Less so.
They're less educational?
Yeah.
Okay. And do you think that parents would give a 12-year-old a graphic novel?
Maybe.
If the 12-year-old requested it, maybe?
Probably.
Yeah. But can you learn from a graphic novel?
Yes.
Okay. Are there any good ones that you have in mind that you would recommend?
Simpsons graphic novel.
Wait. The Simpsons, that's not what I had in mind for a graphic novel.
Oh.
I was thinking of, aren't there others that you've read that have a little more to them than Simpsons? Or is what you're saying that basically kids should read for pleasure and fun, and as long as they're reading, that's a good goal?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you very much for joining us today. And we'll have, maybe we'll have some people put The Simpsons and Calvin and Hobbes and Rick Riordan under the tree.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Okay, now I'm joined by another in-studio guest, Jack Wilson Jr. Jr., who's here to give us another perspective on good books to give to kids for the holidays. Jack Wilson Jr. Jr., how are you today?
Good.
And how old are you?
I'm 9.
Okay, so do you tend to get books for Christmas?
Yes.
Is that a good gift in your view?
Yeah.
Do you, what kind of books do you like to read?
I like to read graphic novels, but I also like to read regular novels with chapters.
Oh, okay. How many books do you think you've read in your life? You have an estimate?
Too many.
Too many? What? Why would it be too many? Most people say I haven't read enough. You feel like your brain is full?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I'm gonna help you estimate how many books that you've read in your life. So you go to the library about once a week, right?
Yeah.
And you get about 20 books?
Yeah.
And you pretty much read them all?
Yeah.
Okay. So 20 times 50 would be about 1,000 in a year, right? And you've been doing that for... For 2 years?
But so, then I've read other books that have been, but not the library books.
Right, books we have at home on the shelf.
Yeah.
And books that you get at school.
Yeah, school.
And you've listened to audiobooks.
Yeah.
And you've been doing that since you were about 5, I think, so about 4 years. So maybe you might be getting close to 5,000 books. I'd say you're probably an expert by now. Okay, and you can't just nod. You have to talk into the microphone.
Yes.
Okay, so you consider yourself an expert in books for kids.
Yeah.
Okay, so what do adults tend to think that kids would like? If you left an adult alone, you didn't give him any advice, and he or she went to the bookstore to pick out a book for a 9-year-old, what do you think they would come up with?
I think they would come up with long and huge books. Ooh. With really small worlds and...
Small worlds. Oh.
Yeah.
Like what do you mean by a small world?
Like it doesn't have a lot of...
Imagination. Yeah. So a small world, it might be a world that doesn't change too much or does it?
And most of the characters do not change. Their character traits do not change.
Oh, and you like books that are a little more inventive, a little more fantastic?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have an example of a kind of book that you would like?
Fantasy books by experienced writers.
Ooh, experienced writers. That's interesting.
Like Rick Riordan.
Oh, Rick Riordan. Okay. So what is there a book in particular of Rick Riordan's you would recommend for somebody just starting out with Rick Riordan?
Just starting out with Rick Riordan. There are a few stories, but I would recommend Percy Jackson and the Olympians.
Okay.
The Lightning Thief. Oh, the first book.
That's the first one in that series.
That's the very first book he wrote.
Okay. Yeah. But wait. You said you liked experienced authors, and now you just recommended somebody the very first book that he wrote. Is Rick Riordan an exception to this policy of yours?
Well, he gets better.
Oh.
Yeah, like his books get better.
Okay, so you got to get through the first one. Maybe that one's tough because he's not that experienced. And then as you go further in the series, he gets better and better.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's good for an author to keep improving. Okay. So any other recommendations for people who are looking to buy a book for a 9-year-old?
Probably books that are basically chapter books, but they have lots and lots of pictures.
Mm.
Like some books like Big Nate or Diary of a Wimpy Kid.
Oh, okay. Let me ask you something. Don't you think an author's goal is to make you visualize things in your mind so you don't need pictures?
It depends on what kind of book they're making.
Okay.
Like if they're making a chapter book that's supposed to be really long, then you probably wouldn't want pictures with that, because if it's descriptive, then you wouldn't even need that.
Right.
But sometimes to get the point of a joke, you would need like a picture or a drawing.
Oh, so it can add something to it even.
Yeah.
I see. And maybe make you laugh in a different way or maybe
yeah.
convey an emotion in a different way.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you, you've written some stories, right?
A little.
And when you were writing them, did you wish that you could also draw pictures to go along with it? Or were you comfortable just sticking to the words that you were putting on the page?
I was comfortable putting the words on the page, but if I was better at drawing, I would definitely want to draw.
Oh, right. That would have added a little bit something if you had a little more skill.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's honest. Okay. So is that pretty much the list? Are there any books that you would recommend avoiding for Christmas, or any types of books that you would tell parents, stay away from these because your kids probably won't like it?
Historical fiction.
Historical fiction, okay.
Because we, fourth graders, they read enough of that in school.
Oh, okay. So it feels a little bit like homework or
yeah.
like an assignment. Okay, well, I think those are good recommendations. And I think Rick Riordan we're going to be, maybe he should sponsor the podcast. He's gotten a couple of recommendations here today.
Yes.
Okay, well, thank you very much for joining me today on the History of Literature podcast.
You are welcome.
What was that?
You're welcome.
Okay. That's going to do it for this episode of the History of Literature podcast. My thanks to all three of my guests. And here's another idea for you holiday shoppers. Professor Zemgulis put me onto this one in a part of the interview that we had to leave on the cutting room floor. Virginia Woolf dolls. Yes, sell those. Professor Zemgulis takes them to class to discuss what it means for Virginia Woolf to have inspired these dolls. How do they reflect our conception of the author? What does she represent in our culture today? And the professor described a magazine spread in which famous authors are shown. I guess it's kind of a fashion spread. The magazine is selling clothing inspired by outfits worn by these famous writers, except that these are all famous writers who committed suicide, and the photos are of them. They're staging their deaths. And then they say you can buy these clothes for the low, low price of whatever it is, the clothes the writers were wearing as they're committing suicide. How awful is that? I was mortified. That's not cool. Trying to make a buck off of tragedy. Some people just, you know, they hear about a tragedy and they just think dollar signs. How morbid is that? Where's the empathy, people? So you could find us at Gar, what happened to the music? Oh. I'm getting a signal from my producer. I guess we're going to play a clip. Are you? Oh, this is the part about the magazine spread with the authors. And okay. Let's hear it.
And I bring it to class, and it's Woolf in a beautiful lace gown committing suicide. And like, they give you the $649 for the gown. And
You buy the things that she was wearing?
Yeah, it's a photo spread. It's one of these new magazines for young people. I forgot what it's called.
Right. Maybe I should see if they'd like to be a sponsor of the podcast. Wait, what? Was that me? Did I really say that? Could we hear that again? No remorse whatsoever. Nothing. Just straight to the sponsorship idea.
And I bring it to class, and it's Woolf in a beautiful lace gown committing suicide. And like, they give you the $649 for the gown. And
You buy the things that she was wearing?
Yeah, it's a photo spread. It's one of these new magazines for young people. I forgot what it's called.
Right. Maybe I should see if they'd like to be a sponsor of the podcast. Oh, man. Wow, I didn't miss a beat. What a monster I've become. See what this podcast and the forces of commerce have done to me. I need to work on that. Thanks, Gar. Thanks for stepping up in your role as producer. Just what the host needs. You can contact me at jackwilsonauthor@gmail.com. That's J-A-C-K-E, wilsonauthor@gmail.com. Just email to say hello. Tell me what's on your mind. Love to hear from you. We'll be back next week. Is it Julius Caesar yet? Bob Dylan? Somebody good, anyway. In the meantime, you can find us on historyofliterature.com or facebook.com/historyofliterature. I'm Jack Wilson. As always, thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.